How do you sort out which songs are going to go onto an album? Because you all write, don't you?
Yeah.
Yes.
We row.
Yeah.
Argue.
Yeah.
We do write individually, so I mean, like, so we go our separate ways for whenever the tour is over or whatever. And then we sort of have a routining period where we sort of get together and sort of play each other the new songs. And then what happens is a sort of a very huge sifting process where we sort of find out what songs...
Like, no way am I going to play that, or...
Things like that. And we always forget work it. Also, okay. Sort of, as far as the individual song is concerned, and also what will go with how the songs will sort of sound with each other. So it's basically sort of looking in terms of an album as opposed to just individual song.
Yeah, we have tried in the past to provide a lot of variety on each album and a lot of contrasts. And so we've had to sort of have a good cross-section of material.
All right, well, let's hear some of the heavy side of your music, The March of the Black Queen from Queen 2.
I thought it was a good idea to play that because Queen 2 is an album which in some ways is the root of all that happened thereafter, I think. And I don't, if people haven't heard that before, I think you could hear that and think that that was something off the new album, really. It still sounds that fresh to me. And there are a lot of things that you can hear, that all the sort of texture work was there, and the intricate harmonies, the guitar harmonies and stuff, sort of the precursor of Bohemian Rhapsody in many ways. So I think that was a very important album for us. It was also the first one which came into the charts.
How long did March of the Black Queen take you to record?
The tape went transparent. Yeah. Genuinely.
Those were the days of 16-track studios. And I think, wasn't it?
Yes, it was 16-track.
You have now 24 and 32-track. But I mean, as we did so many overdubs, I mean, on 16-track, it was like we just kept piling it on and on. And it was like, that's what... Roger means when the tape went transparent because it just couldn't take anymore. I think it snapped in about two places.
It'd gone over the head so many times and overdubbing. The oxide had worn off.
It was a big step for us at the time, certainly, because no one's really doing that kind of thing in those days.
In fact, when this album came out, we were doing our own first headlining tour after supporting Mott the Hoople and gaining an enormous amount of live experience and a large following, really, for a relatively new band.
Well, then, Roger, you went on to support Mott the Hoople in the States, right?
Yeah. It seemed a logical step because it had worked so well, and we got on with them very well personally as well, which doesn't always happen on tours, you know. Mm. It's always good if the bands that are touring together do get on well. And so we really took the logical step and went to America with them as well. And we did learn quite a lot of them. They were a really good live band.
Excellent live band, yeah.
We had a very good American tour up to the point when Brian got hepatitis and collapsed, and we had to come home, at which point things looked very black.
Well, then you did an extraordinary thing. Having supported once in England and having supported once in the States, you then went to headline straight away in England, and then you went to headline straight away in the States.
It was quite rare then, yeah, because we did go to sort of playing the rainbow by ourselves in one sort of step.
We did take a lot of risks, actually, I think. Most of them paid off. Bring back, bring back, bring back that Leroy Brown. Bring back, bring back, bring that Leroy
Brown. Bring that big bad Leroy back. Bring back that Leroy Brown with a ukulele novelty from Brian May there.